Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, do you want to say a thing?
Yep. What is the conversation? Who is it with?
We'll be getting to that in a minute. Just be patient.
I want to know who it is, because then I might be able to guess what it is in advance.
You do realise I'm now going to have to put this at the beginning of the tape.
Yeah.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm John. Excuse me. I've got a feeling that wasn't as funny as it was in my head before I did it.
No.
Okay, well, we're committed now. Anyway, so I've got Stephen here, and which I regret, actually, because this conversation I had very late at night in the Midland Hotel bar on Monday night, when someone came over to tell me they liked the podcast, which is always nice.
Yeah.
And that's something that's happening more these days, which is, you know, lovely. Hello, guys. And I said, oh, thank you. It's a bit frustrating not having a regular co-host at the moment. We're still kind of missing Stephanie. And she said, oh, I really like the ones you do with Stephen. And I was quite drunk. And I went, Stephen's already overexposed. So if I had another option, I probably wouldn't have asked you to come down here and talk about Theresa May's housing policy. But
it's odd, when you said you were going to mention something you'd talk to about me late at night at the Conservative Party conference, I had horrible images of you hearing about an event that shall only be known as the incident.
Okay, you can't not explain the incident now.
So it's not very cities related, but a long time ago, I was a flatmate with someone else who was at Conservative Party conference.
Who is this someone who's also been on this podcast?
It is someone who's also been on this podcast, and I thought it might be about an incident.
What was the incident with
you? The incident can't be discussed on a family podcast, okay?
Okay.
But there was an incident.
If anybody out there knows about the incident involving Stephen and a former guest on this podcast, possibly one who works for BuzzFeed, then do get in touch. But anyway, no, it was just a story about, you know, people being nice to me and then me being horrible to you. Is really, it's just that I'm aware, like, you were only recently on here, and I'm aware when it's the two of us, we're both very much not women, and I feel uncomfortable with that.
But I'm free.
You are free and available for not that long, so we should probably get to the actual topic in hand. So yeah, Theresa May, the somebody told the Sun there was going to be a council house building revolution, and that's not really what we've got, is it? That's not what's happening. I thought it was the most pathetically.
Marina Hyde, in her brilliant post-conference write through, said it emerged into the biggest revolution at Conservative Party conference was the definition of the word revolution.
Yes.
And it's one of those. I think what I also find funny is, right, so it's basically 8 council houses per local authority, i.e. nothing.
I hadn't heard that one. I know it's like an extra 5,000 a year.
So if you then divide it by the number of council houses, local authorities, it's 8.
I also think these figures are optimistic, because if you divide the money by the number of homes they're projecting, they're talking about them costing about £80,000 each, and that seems on the low side to me.
But yeah, it's 8 per council. And the best thing about it is, obviously, they're also putting £10 billion more into Help to Buy. So it really is like, you know, if a fire started in this room, you're going, don't worry, I've got a revolution in how I'm going to find it. Going out, getting a huge tin of petrol, pouring it on the fire, and then like, oh, but don't worry, I bought a super soaker. And just sitting there, like, I mean, it's just, like, it would be an inadequate solution if they weren't also making the problem worse at the same time.
The Help to Buy thing is slightly more complicated than that, because there were several elements to Help to Buy. The one, I believe, I always get them mixed up. I believe the one that we still have was the deposit scheme, the deposit guarantee scheme, which, as I understand it, actually, it's not that it's obvious that it was just bidding up house prices. It's that they can't rule it out, and it seems to vary area by area. Somewhere like London, it's definitely bad news. But in other places, it's possible that the effects you got of... it's possible that, you know, it did kind of give house builders enough certainty to get building more, and that effect may have sort of outranked the effects of pouring more money into the market. Yeah. But this is part of the problem with ever talking about housing, is you kind of instinctively start talking in national averages, and people don't live in a national average house. They live in a house in a specific place. So it's kind of often quite difficult to talk about it.
Yeah.
From a political standpoint, why do you think it was... I mean, do you think they over-briefed it? Or do you think it was just the Sun got a bit overexcited and wasn't as helpful as they imagined they were going to be? Or do you think it's like maybe they just thought, well, we'll get good headlines from this, and that's more important than the fact that it's going to look like a damn squib afterwards? I mean, what the hell is going on there?
I think it will have been a combination of over... I think it will actually have been over-briefing for the most part. Because, I mean, one of the interesting things, and this is not true of everyone who works on policy worked on policy for Theresa May. You know, Will Tanner's stuff in the Eye, now he's left and has become a columnist for them, is very good and actually does have kind of meaty policy solutions. But an awful lot of people, of whom Nick Timothy is probably the most famous example, would continually go, we have a radical solution to insert whatever the problem is, and then with kind of, you know, almost comic levels of fanfare, would find whatever the policy equivalent of that super soaker I was talking about earlier was. I mean, okay, so grammar schools we know are actively do not work. But the idea that even if they did work, then they produce the scale of upskilling you need in the British workforce is for the birds, right? Even if they succeeded for their intakes, they do not have large-scale enough effects, ignoring for a moment the fact that their effects are actually negative. So my guess is it's the kind of same old problem, and it may also have been partly about forestalling objections among conservatives who do get it, which is basically everyone in the 2015 and 2017 intake, a great number of their councillors, and indeed a couple of people from earlier on, I mean, not least Sajid Javid, who's... proposals, I think, are a bit more useful, although I also don't think they will in their current state.
So, Sajid Javid's proposals, if you haven't come across them, are basically involves requiring bigger targets from any council where house prices are significantly above
average. Where they are kind of above the mortgage, then basically where if you cannot get a mortgage on an average salary in this area, the council is required to build until...
Which will make a lot of sense somewhere like Bromley in South East London, where house prices are incredibly high. But unlike... You know, some London boroughs have been quite good at delivering extra housing. Mm. Some of them it's because there's a certain amount of dodginess going on, not naming any Tower Hamlets or Newhams in particular. But also Barnet, which is a Conservative-led borough, was recently, I believe, has also been doing very well, despite being an outer London Tory borough. Bromley, on the other hand, has more empty space than any borough in London. It is literally half empty, and they've not been planning for growth at all. So Javid's policy would be very good at motivating them, I think. Where I can't see it working would be somewhere like Oxford, which has the single worst, least affordable housing in Britain, in terms of if you measure it by wages rather than absolute figures. But they just don't have the land. Like, it's no good telling Oxford Council that you need to build more houses, because they know they do, but there is literally nowhere in Oxford you can do it. So to develop more Oxford, you would have to do it in the neighbouring councils, which places like Cherwell, which are run by the Tories from towns, commuter towns like 10, 15 miles away. So there's just that lever isn't going to work.
Or you could not. I mean, yeah. No, I mean, there are also, and I realise I am about to advocate knocking down my mother's house, but you also could knock down a bunch of two-storey terraced homes in Blackbird Leys and just build
apartment blocks.
Yeah.
But this is why I get uncomfortable with this argument, is because people like densification is a good thing. Like, dense cities are generally better. If you go to like a dense walkable city in Europe, like Paris or Vienna or something, they're generally much more interesting places to be than one built on the car. However, there are two problems. One of which is we're terrible at building apartment blocks in this country. like, for whatever reason, they're just not as nice as those kind of mansion blocks you get continentally, or even in a lot of American cities. And secondly, we never talk about the fact that it does literally mean demolishing people's homes. That's what we're talking about here. There may or may not be compensated for that, but we're talking about demolishing places that are already occupied and in use, and then putting something else there. Which I think is why politicians like from both sides of the fence, like David Cameron and Andrew Adonis, have both talked about. Hey,
it's why I think Create Streets is just a nonsense fantasy.
Yeah, we'll come back to them, but like it's just this idea of like, well, there's all this public sector land. It's like those are council estates, people live there, and not just council tenants. However, a lot of the people who live there, thanks to Right to Buy, own those council flats. Have you forgotten that you're demolishing their homes? If you think it's going to be difficult to win support for building on the Greenbelt, why do you think it's going to be any easier to knock down half of Southwark and rebuild? I just don't understand why people think this is something it's going to be okay to do.
Yeah, I think this is the weird thing about Create Streets is it feels like a policy proposal that would make brilliant sense if they also went, and our plan to solve the housing crisis is to invent a time machine and go back to 1945 and go, so you're about to do an awful lot of rebuild. Why don't you do it like this, right? If your plan is to go back to the Great Fire of London, again, it's a brilliant... However, I don't think my mum listens to this podcast, but if she does, I'm sorry.
She doesn't follow me on Twitter. I follow her, she doesn't follow me back. I have issues with that.
She's very judicious about...
You know whose mum used to follow me on Twitter? Stephanie's mum always followed me on Twitter.
I'm not Stephanie.
Stephanie's mum would often tweet Stephanie about what I've been saying on Twitter, which made Stephanie feel very uncomfortable after what anyone got.
I can see how it would. Ultimately... The fact that people are going to resist having their home knocked down, partly because the other problem in the housing crisis now is because there is a long history of developers going, yeah, you can come back, exactly the same place, exactly the same thing, and going, by exactly the same place, I meant somewhere else, and by exactly the same amount of space in your home, I meant actually less.
Yeah.
Means that this idea that you can go from the current level of trust in the process to Create Streets is for the birds. And actually, we do just need to build out. Oxford could be three times the size it is very easily. And in terms of the population it now, it is a city with more economic activity than it has room to house. And you can see it, again.
Well, this brings us on to the productivity crisis, doesn't it? Yeah. Like, there's stats out a couple of hours ago as we're talking, showing that consistently the Treasury has made predictions based on a certain increase in productivity that hasn't been forthcoming for nearly a decade. And this means it's constantly missing its fiscal targets. And one big reason for that, I think, is because people can't live where the bloody jobs are.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Until we solve the housing crisis, I don't think we're going to solve the productivity crisis. And, a way of increasing productivity would be letting productive cities like Oxford grow so that more people could work in them.
Yeah, exactly. Because obviously the other problem with the housing crisis is that you have you have some people who, thanks to Help to Buy, have got on the housing ladder. And, of course, they have this thing where they have a lot of debt and not very much equity. Which means, and of course, what you ideally need to fix the housing crisis is a prolonged period of house price stagnation and a prolonged period of wage growth, which you only get by A, increasing house builds, and B, increasing wages.
And productivity, effectively.
And productivity.
We're not doing that at all.
Yeah. And so I think what I find weird about the announcement, right, is I could understand if the government just hadn't noticed there was a problem. I could understand if... Because in terms of the things that Javid is putting forward, and I agree with your caveats about why they don't, but in terms of where he ended up...
He at least has some radical ideas, to be fair to the man.
And where he's
trying.
And where he's got now. You can already see the kind of, well, here's where I'd like to be. Oh, there's this thing called Tory backbenchers where they don't have a housing crisis yet. I'm going to have to retreat a bit. Whereas this policy doesn't even... it is already in full retreat, right? It feels in its main devices to get people who in the Tory party are going, we need to fix the housing crisis. It feels like a way of going, there, I fixed it.
Yeah. And to be fair, I did, in Manchester this week, I did encounter quite a lot of Tories who are serious about this. So the South Norfolk MP, Richard Bacon, who I've not met before, was on a panel with me, and he was sort of genuinely sort of quite angry about the inactivity of the party on this. And someone asked, you know, what do you think of Help to Buy? And I think the exact quote was, it's deeply intellectually flawed and bad. Which is, you know, that's quite significant language, I thought, from a Tory backbencher.
Yeah, Philip Lee was talking a lot of sense about it on it, and I mean, one of the
James Jamieson, who's the leader of Central Bedfordshire Council, was saying, like, it's ridiculous. Like, he was saying, I'd love to build more homes. Like, my council is building where it can, but the most sensible thing to do would be to nibble away at some of the crappy greenbelt on the very edge of Greater London. And let people live there, because that's where people want to live. People don't want to be commuting from bloody Bedfordshire. People want to be living in London. The other person I found interesting was head of a very old, very Thatcherite think tank, you know, not one that you would normally associate with state action. I asked him what his solution was, and he said, I think the state needs to get building again.
Yeah.
So there's some thinking going on. It's just none of it has actually sort of percolated up to...
Yeah, and I think... And although, you know, like, no one wants... what happened to her to happen to her. So it feels weird saying it was quite good for her and she had, like, a really humiliating day. But it actually was, because it means instead of people going, wait, you've lost your majority, you've had however many months to think about it, and your solution is this appalling housing policy, everyone's going, oh, God, I'm so glad that didn't happen to me.
Yeah. People are actually focusing on the fact that it was, like, the most embarrassingly sitcom speech of all time, rather than the fact the actual content was bloody terrible. People are just not looking at the content at all, which is, you know, what we're here for. So how would you fix the housing crisis?
So firstly, I would... the thing is, the state needs to step back out of the planning process and step into the building process, and also step into the regulatory process, because obviously we've seen with Grenfell, and we see in general with the cuts to things like fire safety, then the state is not taking the active role it used to in when a building is being planned and going, can you do this? Is this connected? Blah, blah, blah. So it needs to do more of that, less of the and also just strengthen compulsory purchase powers, strengthen the abilities to just go, no, we are in fact going to build here. I mean, on my own block, right, we've got like this weird little like tarmac thing, which is allegedly, according to one of the residents' associations, a playground. I have never seen anyone play on it, and seeing as I've seen quite a lot of broken glass in it, I don't see why anyone would, which could easily have another block of flats in it. It would, you know, get rid of the right to light of some of the terraced houses near to me, but, you know.
You live on a council estate, don't you?
Yeah.
You own.
Yeah,
because I also own, I mean, mine's housing association, but yeah, I also own a flat which is on a North London estate. And I think this is also something that gets missed when people like Adonis are talking about how we should just turn council estates into new villages. Is like they are now full of people like us because it's the only place we could afford.
Yeah. Well, I thought, oh, that was, so in terms of other people with strange opinions about the housing crisis, Dan Davies claiming that, oh, I'll believe there's a crisis when the estates around the edge of Oxford start to gentrify. And it's just like, when that happens, I mean, literally, have you been in a coma since 2005?
I think what Dan Davies is actually saying there is that he's old and he doesn't know any young people. He seems like his 50s. He just genuinely doesn't know anybody who's... he doesn't know people who were like him a generation ago.
But yeah, I mean, but actually, yeah, the reality is to fix the housing crisis, people like me with my 5% of equity do just need to be tipped into negative equity. I can see no sustainable solution for society as a whole which doesn't involve that. But yeah, I would just, more building. I would broadly do a lot of the stuff Sajid Javid is doing, but with more social, with, you know, more social building as well on the side.
No, I'd go
and
ahead.
Compel. I mean, I also think, you know, seeing as I assume in this scenario, then we're just imagining I don't have to like win any votes. We do just need to take a look at who makes political decisions, right? So perversely, there are people in London exurbs who get a better deal on transport because a mayor they don't elect runs their transport, right? And that is slightly bizarre, and it has slight democratic problems, but in a federal structure...
You mean like Epping, Amersham, places on the Tube, yeah, basically?
Yeah, slightly better off than they would, weirdly, if we went, actually, TfL's writ ends...
There used to be a thing, I don't know if it's still true, but there certainly used to be a thing that that some of these border councils would pay so their residents got a better deal,
yeah,
which is how Epping actually ended up in Zone 6. Like, they paid for the privilege, despite the fact that, because, like, once upon a time, like, all that area got rezoned, so half the Hainault loop was in Zone 5, and then only Loughton, I think, was Zone 6, and then beyond that was nothing. But they changed it so that...
And like, now it's in Zone 4, but beyond that still lies nothing.
Which is why they should build some houses there. Yeah. You know, after the Great Fire of London, there were very tight building regulations as to what you could build. Like, there was like there was three or four types of building.
Yeah.
Which is why so many of the sort of great estates in North London kind of have that sort of Georgian terrace look. Because, like, literally someone sat down and said, right, this is what you can build.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought that was just like an architectural style of that period of
time. No, it was regulation. It's a product of regulation.
Oh, that is fascinating.
This is why I mention it, because it's a surprising fact, isn't it? Because you just wouldn't think of it. Firstly, you don't imagine regulation happening in that way in the 17th century. But I think a lot of it was about, like, one of the reasons the Great Fire of London was so bloody terrible was because so many of the houses were timber. So it was partly around not, you know, having stone-built houses rather than timber ones. It was a fire safety thing. But also it was an aesthetic thing. So there's huge estates like the Bedford Estate, as well, like Bloomsbury and so on, that what they call the Great Estates, which all built up very, very quickly in that sort of first period of suburbanisation. There was also an Elizabethan Greenbelt, which I keep meaning to look into, but there were building restrictions to prevent the growth of the city in the late 16th century, which is crazy.
And I think, you know, the other thing I would do is you just do have to restrict slightly who can buy.
See, I think we kind of need an exit ramp from buy to let.
Yeah,
I don't think
that is
we can,
the other difficult solution.
If we could press a button just killing buy to let today, I don't think it would be a good idea. Because, firstly, there's a lot of people who have that instead of pensions, so that you're just creating another crisis. And secondly, like, there is some evidence that you squeeze more people into rental properties than you would if they were owner-occupied. So, in fact, you end up with sort of less space for people, if you see what I mean. Because, like, what is currently a home for, like, shared by, like, you know, three couples may end up being just a house for one couple sort of thing. So you kind of need to wind that down gradually, but it's not clear to me what that looks like. I think maybe they need to sort of come up with some policy where they say, okay, our goal is to make it incredibly financially unadvantageous to be an individual owning property in 10 years' time. We're going to start sort of ramping up tax rates on buy-to-let property. But the good news is we're not doing it right now, so you have time to get out on your own. Do you know what I mean?
But I mean, that is the sort of, because the weird thing is there's a huge amount of rent seeking in buy to let, but there has not been huge rent seeking in buy to let. You know, the rents that have been achieved have not meant that you have landlords sitting on a pot of money. You have landlords where the Bank of England, when they did their last stability check with the various banks, most banks think of a third of their landlords would be underwater with even quite a small rate rise.
Really?
And that doesn't include portfolio effects. So unless you hope that the third is the same third, which is highly unlikely, you're talking about a very overlived... I mean, the first flat I lived in after university was, you know, the circumstances around this particular shared flat. We knew the landlord was not wholly kosher. But at one point, the boiler broke, and he basically had to be like, can you pay me for a couple of days early next month? Because it's a bit tight for me. And obviously, we're like, yeah, okay, but seeing as we give you, like, $1,000...
That's not what you want to hear from the landlord.
Yeah, it's just like, you really should not be, like, this up against it. But that is the big problem with the buy-to-let.
I had the opposite experience. My first house out of university... In 2002, 2003, 2004, around then, was rented through a property company on the Walworth Road in South London that owns, I don't know, a few dozen properties, but it's corporate rather than like. And because I hadn't managed to sort out my bank account for reasons that best unexplored, I would pay them by cheque delivered by hand every month, and sometimes I would just not get round to it, so I would be like 3 weeks late and all apologetic. And then a very nice Lady Wendy around the place would be like, oh, it's fine. It's, I mean, we know where you live. So I think we had a slightly odd experience of... but our colleague Alan Leskowitz also ended up renting from the same agency quite recently.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Teeny tiny world, isn't it? But I think this kind of solution in terms of how do you have an exit for people in buy-to-let is the other part which we haven't talked about, which is mortgage terms. I've said this before, I'm not sure on this podcast or just on the website, but in many ways, in terms of what voters want and the objections of the Tory party, I'm amazed that they haven't paid more attention to Japan in general. And what do they have in Japan? They have 100-year mortgages, where actually you never pay off the debt, because actually in terms of the financialization of housing as asset, that sort of works for everyone. But you do just use it to swap housing either down or up, right? But you actually don't ever, your lease stretches out into the future. And that also allows you to have a, because we do basically need to, in order to not have a situation where a bunch of buy-to-let landlords exit and a bunch of people are suddenly made homeless, yada, 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 to have a period where wages go up and house prices stay flat. But because of the pressures on housing, in many ways, people really have underestimated just how much building you would have to do before house prices went down, as opposed to merely stagnated. So buy-to-let, yeah, there are lots of sort of fairly painless ways out of it.
I think that on the building thing, I think the problem is it's difficult to know how severe the crisis is, because there is an argument that part of it is around the financialization of housing rather than supply demand logic. So, you know, to be blunt about it, like since the crash, there's not been many good places to put your money. Mm. Property is one, particularly property in what Richard Florida has described as superstar cities like London. If you own a square foot of London, that's going to work out pretty well for your bank account. Whereas, you know, it's been quite difficult to find good startups or whatever to invest in. So there's just been this wall of money flooding into property. If interest rates went back up to normal and world growth rates went back up to normal, prices would go down. I just don't think we know. So I don't think we know how severe the housing crisis is, if you see what I mean. I mean, there's definitely, in certain areas, in London and Oxford and Cambridge and Bristol and so on, there is definitely a shortage of supply that we need to fix. But in parts of the country, I think it is just that, like, buy-to-let investors have squeezed out first-time buyers, and I don't think we know until things change.
Yeah.
Two last thoughts before we go. One is, there is, in The Road to Wigan Pier, which George Orwell wrote in 1935... there is a section about how the worst landlords are not terrible corporate monsters. It's little old ladies with two homes who can't afford to fix the boiler, which I meant to say several minutes ago because it wouldn't have fitted in, but I just want to point that out, you know, given that this is the magazine of Orwell. And the other thing is not so much an observation as a question, which is, what was the incident?
No comment.